Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, we present a program with our community partner, the California Institute of Integral Studies. Our guest today is author and cultural critic Mickey Kendall, whose most recent book is Hood Feminism, which takes aim at how the modern feminist movement has chronically failed to address the basic needs of all but a privileged few. She's joined in conversation by CIIS Professor and Program Chair of Expressive Arts Therapy, Daniel Drake. And now, welcome Mickey Kendall and Daniel Drake.
We talked back in March, at the beginning of March, in preparation for this talk, and then we were derailed. The world was derailed and sidelined by the COVID-19 epidemic. And then 2020 proceeded to be, in my estimation, a combined epilogue and case study for the ideas that and experiences that you outline in your book, Hood Feminism, Notes from the Women That a Movement Forgot. So just to start us off, there have been so many things that have happened in the last 6 or 7 months since we were originally supposed to have this conversation. I mean, I feel like the world has changed so incredibly significantly. Can you just off the top of your head, I know it's not going to be exhaustive, but just tell me a couple of the standout events and experiences that seem to have punctuated just a few of the things that you highlight in your book.
So A, thank you for having me. And B, I jokingly, not so jokingly, refer to 2020 as the apocalypse movie that couldn't make up its mind. We have to choose a struggle. Choose your own apocalypse.
I mean, and you have so many to choose from.
At this rate, I'm betting on aliens. Aliens. So I should say this. It was actually really good that you canceled when you did, because when I came home from New York, I was going to come from New York out to the Bay. I had COVID. So I had COVID at the end of March. My thyroid is a Rice Krispie treat now, but otherwise I'm fine. We're fine. And so I think the thing that punctuated it for me is that 200,000 people have died. Millions more have been impacted. And this is just in the U.S. That's before we get to the rest of the world. Millions globally have been impacted, obviously. And I think the number is actually closing in on 1 billion, but I haven't looked at the numbers recently for the global population infection rate. And I've watched many other countries learn their lesson really early, right? They've been able to reduce the spread, do all of these things. And I'm gonna highlight something that happened today, as a matter of fact. A canvasser for a political party that is not one I subscribe to, we'll put it that way, we'll keep it cute, came to my door, and in the process of my, why are you here, it dawned on me. He came without a mask after all of this.
Oh my goodness.
And so the things that stand out about this year for me have been, yes, obviously the political ramifications of many things, the concerns we have about, you know, who's going to get that Supreme Court nod, but also unemployment, the lack of a financial plan that could have made, you know, there's all of this political stuff. And then there's also the personal. There's watching people be anti-vaxxers, people be angry about food stamps and all of these things. And I'm kind of sitting on the sidelines and going, this is how we got here. Like we aren't, this does not have to be an apocalypse. Right? I make jokes, but this doesn't have to be an apocalypse. We are making choices as a society, specifically an American society, that hinge on the idea that we can bootstrap our way out of a pandemic. It's a lie. You can't. First of all, bootstraps don't do anything. You can't pull anything up by bootstraps except a boot. Right? Even if you have straps on a boot, on your actual physical boot, you know what you can lift with it? The boot. That's what you can pick up. Nothing else. You can't even really pick up your foot with it. And so for me, the biggest things have been watching people choose to ignore science, choose to ignore the financial impact. People still vociferously arguing against Black Lives Matter or insisting that things aren't that bad. You know, I saw this thing, a guy made a video about how Black women weren't as likely to be killed by police. So it couldn't just be about race. He carefully stepped around the conversation about the second most common form of police brutality, which is sexual assault. And those numbers can tell you that it is in fact about race. And that is both for Black and Indigenous women in particularly, that we are all in this together, in this struggle together, if you're talking about marginalized communities.
Yeah.
But we're the canaries in the proverbial coal mine. Right? America gets a cold, Black America gets the flu, is that old saying. Well, really, at this point, America gets the plague. The rest of us get what? And I've been watching, you know, not that I want to be watching. This is not a time when I want to be right. I enjoy being right, but not particularly.
Not for this, yeah.
Right. But we're not learning. Holistically, as a culture, we're not learning. For some reason, we still resent the idea that poor people could be able to eat, that we could take care of our neighbors, right? People are watching the eviction crisis sort of form, and they're very upset that they may make less money. But you know what you can't wrap yourself in when you cross over to wherever it is your beliefs will take you? Those pieces of paper. And so for me this year, I'm right. This is bad. It could be better. But also, we have a choice. We have to consistently choose what we're going to do. And it's, we can make people's days worse. We can make things harder. Or we could make things better.
Wow. I mean, you have traversed so many different, you know, specific areas that you highlight in your book. But what I am struck with is just how we really need to focus in on humanity. Like, that is the key right now. We've got to be able to just really figure out what it is that is preventing folks from really being able to recognize humanity in all of its forms, regardless of whether or not it looks like you, you know, and how to extrapolate this need to prioritize the self and shift it towards prioritizing the collective, because that's what we're really talking about here. So what I wanted to do was just get down into a few of the bits of terminology that I think might be helpful for this conversation as we're, you know, continuing mm-hmm. to expand and fold in a lot of different, not only topics that you cover in your book, but a lot of the current events that have happened and are continuing to happen in this moment. So the first thing I wanted to ask you is, what and or who is included in your definition of hood? Now, I have a felt sense of that, being that that's where I'm from, but but I'd love for you to just delineate that a little bit.
So largely, I am talking about marginalized communities, usually inner city, but it can also be the reservation. It can be, you know, there's certain parts, let's be honest here, there's certain parts of rural America that we would call the hood if it were set anywhere else, rural anywhere that we could call the hood, you know, whether you're talking about a barrio, all of that, right? Because I'm going to put this out here. I know we construct drugs as being a problem in the inner city. Meth's not really being cooked in the inner city, kids. It's being cooked on farms in Ohio, right? In Indiana and Iowa and Idaho. So when we're talking about the hood, we're really talking about marginalized communities and various denominations. And I would include the idea that low-income white people live in the hood often. It is just less likely because in America, race informs your access to the ladder of class and sometimes informs where you're born on that particular ladder. But the hood is really that place that the rest of society says is less than, deserves less support, deserves less resources. Right. Right. Being from the hood is often seen as negative. Yet, if you've ever watched after a natural disaster, a hurricane, any of that, right? I know we like to present, I'm in the Midwest, right? So you'll see, oh, well, look at this farmer that went out to cut down the tree that fell on his neighbor's property. If you ever look at when a building collapses in the inner city, it's often young men and women of color, Black, Latino, Asian, they run toward that flame. They run toward that collapse. They start digging people out. No gloves, no masks, no prep, no nothing. Because ultimately, fundamentally, what you see in every marginalized community is that people who have less give more. They do more. People with more, oddly enough, often are loath to give up anything, right? When we're talking about privilege, this is not a finite pie. If you have slightly less than the more than enough, that doesn't mean that you're going without food, shelter, clothing, education, medical care. It just means somebody else has enough. And you have to make do with one less yacht, one less vacation, one less whatever, right? One less fancy bauble. Maybe. Because largely, the other part of this is that when we get into the idea that resources are to be hoarded and this pie is finite and whatever, you'll see people argue against things like a living wage, right? These are the same people who are angry about public assistance. They, you know, if you can't feed them, don't breed them. You're starting to see those kinds of slogans again, welfare queen slogans again. It's people are talking about unemployment and, you know, food insecurity. And the answer here, friends, most Americans are two paychecks away from being in that boat. Maybe you personally could pull out four or five. But I've seen a lot of people say, well, for a rainy day, I have. How many rainy days do you think it takes before that backup is depleted, right? And sure, you might be living well below your means and you're that miser with $2 million tucked in the under your mattress, but you're a rare person. Most people are paycheck to paycheck. And so when we're talking about this, we're really talking about people who think that they should have more than their neighbor because they should have more than their neighbor. That's, you know, what happens outside the hood. What you'll see inside the hood is a version of stone soup over and over again. People are watching each other's children. They're helping each other make it to the end of the month on a limited food stamp budget. You know, they've got some kind of trade of giving rides. I know in my case, I used to get my hair done in exchange for tutoring, right? Those hidden economies, those barter systems are still sharing. Yeah, they're alive and well. They're still sharing. They're how people are making it.
Yes, I was going to say those underground bartering systems are how low-income communities survive. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're really hitting on is this idea that when you have less, it fosters a sense of collectivism. Like everybody's in it. We're all in it together. We have to be in order to survive. Where on the other end of the spectrum, they don't necessarily, you know, folks
in our, not even on the table.
It's not even on because it's exactly, it's competition. And I would also add that because survival is not on the table, then everything turns inward towards the self. It's competition fueled by this false sense of scarcity, like mm-hmm. the scarcity mentality. I'm not going to have enough if I share with you. So no, I'm absolutely not going to share with you.
And the more they don't share, mm-hmm. the rougher it gets.
Yeah.
The worse it gets.
Yeah. Okay, so we have now working definition of the hood. and so what I wanted to do was to move into feminism. And you present lots of different ways of looking at it. You know, womanism, which I have understood and studied and all of that. Black feminism comes into that conversation. Intersectional feminism comes into the conversation. And then we have hood feminism. And I'm just really interested in hearing from you, like how hood feminism really starts to define itself within, you know, those various categories. I'll just start by saying for me, like, as I started thinking about it, I was like, there's something about hood feminism that feels like there's a rawness that can sometimes be obscured within the terminology of intersectional. And I started to really appreciate that because I think it goes back to even your definition of the hood, which is really sort of this intersection of systemic oppression and economics, that when those two come together, and systemic oppression can look like systemic racism, it can look like community violence, it can look like, you know, the war on, you know, just drug, mm-hmm. all of the things, right? But inside of that, when you start to blend economics and just systemic oppression together, and then you sort of marry that, you combine that with any other of the various parts of identity, it starts to look real, real different, especially when we are talking about feminism.
Well, and one of the things about hood feminism is that sometimes the folks who don't have the right terms, who are going to make missteps, they're still the folks who are going to show up for you. And in my case, when this was first coming together, I had gotten a bunch of threats and they were significant and all of these things in response to me writing about a medically therapeutic abortion. And feminism said, well, let's put you on a stage. Let's get you to testify. Here's some more work for you to do. But it was women in the hood who may not have used the right words, who may have been really rough, but they were like, girl, you good? You got enough to eat? You got a place to stay? Right? My brother, my cousin, whoever, they're going to drive by. They're going to stop by. You know, there was a woman in, I want to say, Queens, New York. She was being threatened by neighbors. She had tried all of the calling of the police and all of these things. But when her story went viral, it wasn't feminists that showed up necessarily. It was Crips, right? Sometimes, I know, and I'm not trying to defend, because I know someone's going to have a whole, oh my God, criminals. But I'm going to point out that a lot of gang culture comes out of neighborhood self-defense. It doesn't mean it ended up there, but a lot of it comes out of neighborhoods that had been heavily oppressed. And we understand that when we're talking romantically about bootleggers or the Italian mob stories or whatever. We understand these concepts. And when it comes to other communities, we struggle with it. But every community has a right to some form of self-protection if they aren't getting protection from anywhere else. And so one of the things I think people don't understand when I'm talking about hood feminism, it's not that I don't expect people to learn or to be better as they go, but I want to leave space for people to make the journey.
Yes.
For people to not know all the right words, all the right theories, but still show up.
Yes. How do we call people in instead of policing them?
Right. And it's not to say there aren't people you have to set hard boundaries against, but there's a big gap between this person is directly a threat and this person used the wrong terminology. Like, I'd rather start with attempting to educate, not to say, because Lord knows if you read my tweets, I can get real spicy when it becomes clear that somebody ain't here for good reason.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
But I want people to think about, you don't start out knowing everything. You don't know the right
Everybody
way.
Everybody starts somewhere.
Right.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean that you shouldn't strive to be better, but I think people dismiss the hood, and particularly women of color and, you know, and poor white women in the hood, because of how they speak, because of presentation, because of respectability politics.
I was going to head right there. Let's go there. Because I think that there is, like, within feminism, there is this way in which softness and politeness is sort of pedestalized. And often what it leads to is this, this is a term that the young people taught me, toxic positivity. And I was like, absolutely, there it is. toxic positivity, really connecting with respectability politics and making it so that, you know, if you don't look a certain way or you don't sound a certain way, you come in with your baby hairs and your eyeliner to here, whatever. Now I can't talk to you because you're not on my level.
You're listening to author and cultural critic Mickey Kendall, whose most recent book is Hood Feminism. She's joined in conversation by California Institute of Integral Studies professor Daniel Drake on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, and I think a lot when we're talking about that, about respectability, there's also a weird form of tone policing that isn't just how are you presenting physically, but it becomes, is your voice soft enough? Are you kind enough? Did you clap and have enough smiley emojis in whatever you said?
And this comes up in academia a lot, because when, and this is what I see, and I'm having to constantly, you know, have conversations with folks about presentations looking lots of different ways. Just because someone doesn't, you know, use the terminology that you're comfortable with doesn't mean that they were not saying something that was important, and that, you know, professors can get caught in that too and then start to be punitive to students who, you know, come from a different culture. We're being strong in your presence, in your affect, in your words, is how you get through life. Like, it's how you navigate the world. You know, this shows up in academia and workplaces and, you know, all of that. And so just really speaking to how the importance of noticing, like, when it has sort of gone into that respectability politics. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's the thing, because then when you get into that moment, you stop listening, right? And you are often not listening to someone's lived experience, right? So I'm watching people, especially right now, these long lines at food banks and all of these things, and people talk about how difficult it was to get unemployment claims and all these other things processed. And I'm in conversations about what forms they took with them to apply for things. Right. And if they had talked to someone who had previously been poor, they would have known the entire complete list and packet and checklist to bring with them to speed this process up. But they don't. And they didn't know anyone or didn't listen to anyone. And, you know, I was having this conversation here recently with someone about the fact that I self-describe, and I mean it, I'm not nice. I really am not a nice person. People think I'm a nice person because I'm not mean to them. But you've never given me a reason to be mean to you. So no, I'm not going to be mean. But it doesn't mean that I'm going to be a doormat if you give me a reason, right? And it feels like sometimes people see someone with the wrong presentation and then they expect them to be grateful to be in the presence of the academy, of whoever. And when that's not what happens, because essentially what you're doing is being demeaning to someone, then they're upset that this person has responded poorly or responded in a way they feel is inappropriate. Where you never offered them anything but conflict. You never offered them anything but disrespect. So you got what you gave, right? And they have often information you need. They know and do things that you do not, right? And I liken it to this. When people will say, years ago, I worked at a university, and I was in an elevator, and a young finance student said something really rude about plumbers, right? He was really upset because some guy they had gone to high school with is a plumber now and made the same money as a plumber he was planning to make with his degree. And I was trying. I promise y'all I was trying. But as he talked, I looked at him and I said, "Do you know how to fix a sink? Do you know how to make sure that septic water doesn't back up in your house? Do you know how to plumb a house, much less an entire building? Do you know how to make sure that it's carried away in a sanitary fashion so that disease doesn't spread, so that the smell doesn't? I couldn't grasp why he thought he deserved so much more money because he knew how to move money around, because that's essentially what we're doing. You know how to play in the stock market. You know how to gamble or invest or whatever. Tell someone where to put their money. That's a skill. I'm not saying it's not a skill, but that skill is not more valuable than making sure we don't all get dysentery or cholera, right? Like these are different skill sets. And, you know, and we had what ended up being a relatively productive conversation because he had never thought about those things. But also, he had clearly imbibed so heavily that he didn't think about, I use a toilet every single day. I use a sink. I use a shower. I am exposed to someone's work in this field all day. But I don't think it's important.
Right. That there's a hierarchy of skill. What you were doing was engaging this person with questions of curiosity, which mm-hmm. we often talk about in the world of therapy when we're trying to get, you know, people to, you know, make some changes and things like that. But there was something about your talking about not being nice. And so you had sort of traversed, I think, being raised by your grandmother, who had, you know, some ideas about, I'll just say femininity. But then on the other end of the spectrum, to sort of broaden it and take it to a more social level, you know, this idea about superwoman and sort of a strong Black woman. And then so how do you find yourself like mediating these two, you know, poles while also like declaring your humanity and like fragility and vulnerability and all of that?
So I will say that my fragility and vulnerability are definitely an inside the house thing. There are only a few people who ever get to see. Otherwise, I'm trying to find a way to phrase this that won't sound, but I'm just going to say it.
Yeah, I was like, well, we're talking about hood feminism. So
right, like, listen, look at, like, this is the thing. I tell people when necessary, I remind them that this voice that you hear, this is code switching. But I'm really from the hood. And if you want it, I got it. We can always get to it. So you decide who you want to meet. Because the real me in here, she don't sound like this, but she does talk with her hands. So you figure it out. And when we get to that point, I've seen people kind of, right? It's a surprise for them. But I balance it that way because I've realized that the world does not have a lot of mercy or comfort or kindness for young Black women. Doesn't have a lot of mercy or comfort or kindness for older Black women. Doesn't have a lot of mercy, comfort, or kindness for Black people in general, right? And when I say women, I don't just mean cis women. I mean trans women. I mean non-binary. I mean we are sometimes all we got, right? So if you're gender non-conforming, you're femme, whatever, you have whatever your community is. But there's a reason the world keeps saying, well, Black women are going to save us. Well, listen to Black women. And then they want to make us the mules and the martyrs. And I think about that a lot. And then I decide, sometimes on a case-by-case basis, where is this energy going and how much of it am I willing to expend? And so the balance I try to strike is, what can I live with? When I look at myself in the mirror every day, what can I live with? And what I can live with is it. What I cannot live with, what I cannot abide, what I can't, that's the rest of it. But I have given up on trying to fit into other people's boxes. I am sure, literally right this minute, there's someone within the sound of my voice constructing a box in their head that they think I should fit in. I won't. I promise you I won't. I am an amorphous blob that grows and projects as necessary. Functionally, as are, frankly, most people of color, right? Because if we can't be chameleons, if we can't figure out how to code switch, how to fall back or push forward in a moment, we don't survive. adaptability is really what we got.
And I really love how it's always coming back to this survival piece.
Survival is a religion. Absolutely. I'm going to say this. Survival is, for some people, survival is the only religion they'll ever know. Right? And I know how people are going to hear that. I'm not saying you have to be religious. I grew up in the church, but I'm not really religious. I'm agnostic-y something. I don't think about it a lot, not because I couldn't, but because I don't really care. But I think that people need to understand that when your first priority has to be surviving to the next day, the next week, the next month, we then can't turn to people who are focused on survival and say, why aren't you thinking about these other things? Why aren't you thinking about these wants when your needs are unmet? And a lot of times when I'm talking to other young, not even young, when I'm talking to other Black women, right? But if you talk to older Black women, they'll tell you in a minute. I stopped worrying about, insert the rest of this sentence here. I was someone, whatever. All of those things are your business. I have a saying, other people's opinions of me are none of my business. How you feel about whoever is your business. It's not necessarily their business.
And how different that is, how different that is than a lot of the ways that feminism tends to show up, you know, largely in mainstream society, that it's really focused on how other people are viewing them or me or whatever. And it's really not about that. It's about, and I love that you said this, what can I live with at the end of the day? Mm-hmm. You know, and can I look myself in the mirror and say, I did every single thing that I could, and I left it all out on the floor, and I am happy to bear whatever consequences come from this because I am standing in my truth. And that truth is sort of rooted in this idea of communalism and collectivism, mm-hmm. and, like, you know, enough for everybody.
Well, and I point out to people that if they need a selfish reason to want everyone to have enough, you want to end crime? Make sure everyone has enough to eat and a safe place to live. You want more inventions? Make sure everyone get an education. Right? You want whatever, insert thing here, right? You want the flying car future. We don't get to the flying car future when we're still standing in a Jim Crow past. The flying car, Jetsons future that technology would like to give us, you know, self-driving cars and towers in the sky. You know, I have a conversation with a friend of mine about the Jetsons and how it's kind of a horrifying thing when you think about the fact that you never saw what was below the clouds. What was below the clouds.
Oh. Oh, wow.
You never knew what was down on the ground.
Wow.
Right?
I didn't even think about that.
You knew that everything below the clouds was apparently bad. They didn't go there, but they never talk about it.
Yeah.
And I don't want to live in the future where I have to ignore the ground, where I have to stay perpetually in my shiny ivory tower, lest something that I didn't take care of, right? It's kind of like building a house on a rotten foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if my house is beautiful and shining, but it's also sinking, what difference does it make that I've built this beautiful, ornate home? The ground under it is crumbling, or it's filled with lead, or radioactive, or whatever, right? And so when we're talking about mainstream feminism, a lot of times the focus is on how far up can I get? How could I get to be the CEO, whatever, right? And there's nothing wrong in theory with wanting power. But the question is, what are you going to do with the power once you have it?
And who did you leave behind?
Well, and that's the thing, because if you got all this power, A, how did you get it? Right? How did you get it? And then B, what are you doing with it? Because if you have the power to change the world for women, change the world for Black people, whatever, and instead of using it to do that, you decide to use it to enrich yourself, to enrich your cronies, whatever. And then enriched isn't even necessarily just about money. Let's just say you're hoarding the power, you're hoarding the resources in whatever way works for you, as an analogy. You didn't fix any problems, and you just added to the problem. And that bill comes due in so many ways, what we're seeing right now. I know we tend to blame what's sitting in the Oval Office, and there are reasons for that, but we didn't get here in 4 years. We didn't get here in 40 years, right? We can trace a lot of these policies to literally whether we're going to go with 1619 or earlier. And then after, right? And choices are made over and over again. And so then now that we're here and the bill is coming due, so to speak, we don't want to pay this bill. But some people want to keep adding to the tally.
Yeah. I just, as you were talking about that rising and, you know, this notion of, you know, how did you get there? And, you know, mm-hmm. what are you going to do with it once you have that power? I just think about, you know, the way that it's often mentioned in the Black community about lifting as you climb.
Mm-hmm.
And I often think about this because the other thing that I know about that position is that it is lonely up there. It's lonely. You don't know who has your back.
No one.
You know, and you've not opened the door wider for others to come through so that, you know, each level and each moment and each part of it can be enriched and expanded. And I feel like that's one of the offerings that hood feminism has, is that it's really, you know, just going back to the collectivism, you know, you bring with you everybody. I'm bringing everybody. We always say, oh, I got the hood on my back, you know, and it's real. It's like, how do you bring everyone with you so that they can all enjoy the fruits?
Well, and not only that, not only the bringing everyone, but I want to eat. I'm going to want the cornbread, the buttermilk, all that. I'm going to want somebody that knows how to fry chicken. I'm a Black girl that can't really fry chicken. I'm just going to admit that. you know, I'm going to want people to talk to. I'm going to want people who were there. Like, I'm going to want socially, emotionally, all of these things. And to be honest, when this goes back to the what you can live with, I never want to be the reason a kid is going hungry. I never want to be the reason that somebody is where I was. You know, I had a not so great first marriage, and I remember what hunger and fear feel like, right? And no one, even if I don't like you, I don't want you to experience that, right? We cannot like each other from our separate spaces, but I think you have a right to be safe and warm and comfortable and your kids to be educated and all of those things. We just don't have to be friends.
Yeah. One of the things that you mentioned and sort of exploring your book is, you know, this idea of the damage that is done by people who celebrate Blackness and Black women's culture and fierceness, as long as it doesn't come from Black women, and in particular, poor Black women. And then I want to sort of, you know, just say there's that piece. And then sort of on the other side, this phenomenon that seems to be cropping up that I am, quite frankly, like, I'm puzzled and shocked in a lot of ways, but, and then not, you know, you've got the Karens and the Beckys and all of that. But then the white women who have been posing as women of color coming out the woodworks. Like, what is happening here?
I'm going to hurt a bunch of people's feelings. And I'm going to tell you that those white women are posing as women of color because they cannot succeed as white women. And they feel like if they can take advantage of colorism, they can compete with darker skinned Black women with a leg up, so to speak. Because if you look at the ones that we have seen,
mm-hmm.
and then we look at the, you know, the prototypical white standard of beauty and so forth and so on. physically, they are maybe not able to compete with the Beckys. We'll say Beckys. With the Beckys and the Heathers. Okay? And socially, they seem not to be great, even as they pretend to be Black. But they tend to choose primarily places where they will not interact with a lot with other Black people, or where they can have some measure of power to drive Black women out, or to keep Black women out.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is author and cultural critic Mickey Kendall, whose most recent book is Hood Feminism. She's joined in conversation by California Institute of Integral Studies professor Daniel Drake. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
It is because while people love Black cool and Black culture, they don't necessarily love Black people, especially Black women, because we require a lot, right? Not that we're a handful, not that we're too difficult, but we spend our entire lives hearing we have to do twice as much to get half as far. So we work at everything.
And have really high expectations.
Right. And we hold other people to the same standards. However unfair, yes,
to us.
Right. So it's very difficult sometimes to look into the face of Black women who couldn't pass a paper bag test and think about how hard they had to work and what obstacles they had to overcome to sit at the same table as you. And sometimes it's almost more comforting to then take advantage of the one thing that, frankly, we can't access past a certain skin shade, which is colorism, right? This idea that lighter makes you better. Because at least of the ones that I have seen, and I've seen a couple, these are not convincing simulations. One girl's lips look like somebody just cut a hole in her face. I couldn't quite understand what had happened there, that we fell for this. But then I realized that she had carefully chosen who she engaged with. She went for that loophole of, you are color struck, as my granny would say. You are focused on lightness and proximity to whiteness. And so I'm going to cozy up to you and not to people who are connected culturally and socially, right? And I'm going to do my best to alienate the ones who are, anyone who might question me.
Right. And those are usually the ones that are carrying the high standards, like, well, what's happening with you in the community, and what are you doing to lift this
right.
time? And, you know, why
and they want a woman that is a darker complexion to have 4 degrees, coddle their egos, cook. There's some other things on this list that are unfit for it, but I know you know what I'm talking about. And then they aren't up to the standard they're trying to set either. They don't necessarily have that same level of education, that same level of ability of doing things. All they have is that they would like that space to be occupied by someone that they feel is attainable. So there is that peg. There is also the peg that when you are talking about Karens also visually can't keep up with Becky and Heather. Maybe don't feel like they can try and slide over, right? They're more obsessed with white supremacy than cool, than access to Black cool. But Karens want power and control they don't have at home, is my theory. It's a working theory, but I have never in my life seen so many people choose battles that are completely unnecessary.
I mean,
and the consequences are, right, the consequences are largely the same every time, as are the terrible apologies, right? So you do this thing where you decide that you're going to block. I saw a video recently. A woman tried to block a family from getting into their car because she decided they had stolen their own car or something like that. I was a little confused by the argument that was going on. And I know someone's going to say, well, maybe she was mentally ill. She didn't appear to be. She was just convinced the car belonged to her friend. The friend was not present, It was a bizarre moment where she was certain she was right. The cops come and she got arrested. But what was telling to me was that, you know, unlike, you know, Amy Cooper and others who call the police and whatever, blackness, she just kept demanding that they wait for this friend, whoever the friend was, to arrive. Well, they call the police. They tell the cops in advance, there's a woman, white, and they describe her, and she's, you know, I could tell them you were black, blah, blah, blah. And I'm watching the whole thing, and the entire time I'm thinking, there is nothing else in your life that you have power over, control over. And you're offended that these people won't give you power and control. And I feel like that's the two sides of this coin, is the power that tie these two sides together, right? I cannot get power, so I become a Karen, right? Or what power I have, I can exercise in the very Becky Heather kind of way for as long as I can through whatever means. But if these avenues aren't open to me, then I become, you know, suddenly my great grandmother's a Cherokee princess. I am black on my dad's side or whatever. Like, insert your fake ethnic identity here. Or you move a few hundred miles and you just tell everyone, right, that one of your parents is not your parent. And then you invest heavily. I noticed this with several of the Jessica Krug and some of the others. They were trying very hard to police other people's identity, other people's blackness all the time because they were insecure or whatever, but also they were still looking for that rush, that dopamine rush of being a Karen would give them, right? And I'm going to bring up Rachel Dolezal now, and I'm going to point out that Rachel Dolezal, while apparently committing some measure, she was charged with welfare fraud. She did absolutely nothing, this person who was supposedly on the side of black people, to subvert the welfare queen stereotype. She made a point of going to court in full, not really black blackness. And in that, she behaved very much like the con artist that stereotype is based on, Linda Taylor, who was, for the record, apparently a white woman. There is some question she may have been white and something else. But either way, she passed as a lot of different races because she was an accomplished con artist. That was really her story. She was a criminal.
So the questions on the Q&A, okay? So the first one, could you speak to refugee communities of color globally being included in this conversation and the Black Lives Movement in general?
So I'm going to say this, and I'm not at all an expert, but as America stares down the barrel of perhaps creating some internal refugees itself, again, because side note, the Great Migration is really sort of an internal refugee migration both times because people were escaping from violence in the South to the North because they thought they were going to a better life. The historian in me just had to say that because otherwise, I don't know, lightning strikes historians who don't tell you that. I think at this point, and this is consistent actually, unfortunately, I know people will say that it is all capitalism, but I actually think in any structure, anti-blackness is global. And that for communities, especially refugee and other marginalized communities, there is not a place where you are safe from anti-blackness. I wish I could tell you that there was such a place, but even once you get to places that are theoretically for black people, you always run the risk of colonialism, imperialism, other things impacting and internal conflicts, lack of resources, right? And so a lot of the conversation, unfortunately, has to center around the idea of combating anti-blackness specifically, and then also combating xenophobia, homophobia, and all of the other isms that we talk about when we're talking about hate, because we're really rolling this clock back to the way that hate is addictive and the ways that even in terms of places where everybody is theoretically from the same background, right? And this is true whether we're talking about civil wars in the U.S. or in other countries, we have a problem where we, as a society, A, think and this is a global thing, that resources are finite. We actually have enough food. We have enough to go around. We don't move it around well. And we start hoarding really weird things. And we don't think of wealth as hoarding. But I'm just going to point out to you that if someone had $9 billion of anything else besides dollars, you would call it hoarding. $1 billion, really. So there are those things. And then there is the fact that as long as we say, oh, it's not race, it's insert class, insert gender, insert your it's, we are setting up this false dichotomy where these things are separate. I cannot take off being a woman any more than I can take off being Black. And in fact, if you ask me identity, I would say Black woman, because I am both of them all the time. At the same time, they are not divisible in my person. Right? And so that's, and the same can be true for any other identity related, whether you are Black and a refugee, you are Black and LGBTQIA, all of these things. And as long as we are not talking about racism as a global specific problem, and about anti-Blackness in particular, unfortunately, communities and their place are going to have to be, and this is going to sound twee, and I'm sorry in advance, that all Black lives matter. And until all Black lives matter, no Black lives matter enough. And that has to be the messaging in whether you're in the US, the UK, anywhere. Because otherwise, what tends to happen is that in a time of crisis, I'm going to point to the Windrush generation in the UK for this. In a time of crisis, places will say, come in, we want you, we need you, we need people here, we have a place for you. And then when you have enough, and now I'm going to point to Tulsa and Windrush and other places, and you start to prosper because the anti-Blackness is never addressed, now that is seen as an attack on them. Right? And that is Tulsa, that is Rosewood, that is sending the Windrush generation back to the islands they left 40, 50 years ago with no warning. Whole communities are destroyed. Wealth is disrupted. Finances are disrupted. You will sometimes see in these conversations people saying that Black people don't build, don't try, don't work together, right? There's a weird Hotep-y strain of folks that'll say we don't invest in community. Actually, largely, Black communities are among the few, us and sometimes Indigenous communities, where self-investment is punished. Where the building of banks or community wealth, Black Wall Street, right? The Red Summer of 1919, which was actually like about 3 years of violent attacks on not even wealthy, frankly, but just healthy Black communities, right? Right. Is really about the ways that anti-Blackness has never been addressed historically, right? You have Central Park in New York. You have, I'm going to say it's Freedman's Village or something. I know there's a place in Nova Scotia where they did the same thing. Yes, in Canada. Like, you pick a country, you pick your people, and colorism is another thing that, although we were talking about in the context of Blackness here, that is also part of the scale. That means that whether you were talking about Asian communities that struggle with it or other communities that struggle with colorism, we have created this narrative globally that being of a darker skin tone is bad. And that it says something about your character and who you are as a person and all of these other things. And then when we don't address it, and that, because this is where I'm going to say it, that problem rises, right? So you're at the bottom of the scale because of your skin color. And then let's say all of the Black people got up and left tomorrow. All of the Black people, everyone darker than a paper bag, picked up and just left the planet, hopped on the nearest ship to Mars. It wouldn't fix the problem. It would just change the scale. Then it would be people who were the same color as a paper bag who were too dark. They leave. And you see what I'm saying? Like, there's this ongoing thing. And so for refugee communities, I wish I could tell you that there was some magic pill that would make this better or easier. Unfortunately, until we're all talking about anti-Blackness and about hate consistently in every culture and why we're hoarding resources, I think we're just moving around who's most at risk, right? And we're sort of shifting the, this group is facing this list of obstacles, that group, because no Black community that I know of, it's healthy, thriving, and safe with no outside bigotry to face or internal bigotry to combat. I don't know of one. If you do, please tell me. I would like to go there.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. How can predominantly white women nonprofit organizations do more to impact the issues that are impacting marginalized communities that they volunteer in?
So money goes a long way. Also, I know volunteerism is a thing, but you need to ask yourself if you're volunteering to actually help or you're volunteering for the rush of feeling good about yourself. And I'm not saying you can't do the right thing for the wrong reason, but the latter tends to lend itself to a refusal to listen and follow the lead of the people who will live with the consequences. And I always think in any situation where you want to help, you want to be whatever, if you're not going to have to live with the impact, you shouldn't have the mic. You should show up and do what the people who are going to have to live there after you leave want you to do. Those are my basic in a nutshell things. A, use that privilege in ways that you are asked to use it, right? Whether that is standing in the front line of the protest between the cops and the protesters, contributing to bail funds, speaking up when, you know, Bob in accounting is a creep, you know, pick your poison here. But don't assume that you get to be the star or the hero or that, frankly, they're going to make you feel good about yourself. That's your own internal stuff to bag. Don't bring your emotional needs to someone else to feed.
And I would also add using your power and privilege to help with legislation. Mm-hmm. Like that's, I think, the piece that feels the most, the piece that doesn't get spoken enough or, you know, demonstrated enough.
All of those boring bond meetings about school board funds and things like that. Also, just going to say to the 53%, the house is on fire. Start putting the fire out. Right? Change how you vote. And I don't just mean at the 4-year mark. I mean all the way down. Because your local elections are also very important. Your local bond issues about how schools get funded, about after school programs, all of those things, they're all very important. Show up for those things. And, you know, this is really twee, but vote like Black people. Vote like Black women specifically.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much for this conversation. Really appreciate you and all of the wisdom that you shared tonight, Miss Mickey.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's program was a co-presentation with our community partner, the California Institute of Integral Studies. Our guest was author and cultural critic Mickey Kendall, whose most recent book is Hood Feminism. She was joined in conversation by CIIS professor Danielle Drake. Special thanks to Patty Fort of CIIS. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.